3, 2, 1.
That was perfectly synchronized the way we did that countdown. I think all our episodes should start with that.
With a countdown?
Yeah, I think so.
Man, that'd be really original. I think we'd burn up iTunes with that kind of
I think so. And then we'll go right into Taxman. You know, I think.
Killing it, man. Hey, Taxman, tax season. You paid your taxes yet?
I did. I don't want Erwin R. Scheister to cut a promo on me in front of everybody about being a tax cheat.
Was that his real wrestling name, Erwin R. Scheister, IRS?
Yeah, right, yeah. Scheister. I mean, he had other names, but that was the one that is most beloved.
How unoriginal.
Every time there was some like real life thing that happened to Vince McMahon, like his response would always be to create a heel character that he could use to like vent his frustrations about that. You know, like the IRS looked into him, and then all of a sudden, Erwin R. Scheister, this guy who accused everyone of being a tax cheat, showed up.
Right, and he wears a white shirt, black tie, with a briefcase.
Yeah, I did like that. There was no one that I remember previous to that who wrestled, you know, in business clothes, business attire.
Did he come? What happened to him then? Did he end up becoming Razor Ramon?
No.
What happened to IRS? He looks like him, right? Though, no, whatever happened to him? He had the dark hair.
I think you're misremembering him. They were contemporaries. They were.
Oh yeah, that's
right. They even feuded over the Intercontinental Belt. You know, and the whole advent of the 1-2-3 Kid. When Razor went, he teamed with the Kid against Money Incorporated. You know, but previous to that, you know, he was Mike Rotunda. He was in the Varsity Club, and they played up the fact that he was a very good amateur wrestler from Syracuse, New York, and then he became IRS. And then he did get hurt a lot. He ended up going to WCW then for a while, and he's now an agent. He's like, they don't call them agents anymore. Now they call them producers. That is to say, because he's so experienced, you know, he has so many years of veteran experience in the business. This is how the WWE does their matches. This might be very, very interesting if you didn't know this. Like they will assign you, like let's say you're supposed to wrestle somebody for television. Someone will come up to you and say, the two of you are wrestling, you know, and you have so much television time to fill. And then a producer, or what the job that used to be called an agent, gets assigned to your match. And he sort of helps construct what's going to happen and make sure that it tells the right story and that it fits within the time constraints. And it's kind of done, I think it's done as a way to help inexperienced guys or guys who maybe, or girls, who don't have like a full grasp of the way the structure is done or things like that. They sort of usher them to a Vince McMahon style match. And that's kind of a crazy thought to somebody like me who's always been on the independents, right? I never worked for WWE or WCW or any of the major companies, because that's a tremendous amount of creative freedom that's taken from you and assigned to someone from a generation or two ago whose tastes may not match yours. And I think if I was ever put in that position, I would find it to be a very frustrating experience.
Yeah, but you like to have control. I've known you for a while. I think that's one of your
do you think
one of your character,
character would you call character flaws?
That's the problem when you get involved in sort of a like large corporate mentality.
Right. Yes.
You get sucked into it, and you can't. That's why all these companies really try to stay like lean startups, because they feel like they can evolve, they can fail quickly and move on.
What is the quickest way we can fail? Keep the corporate bigwigs away.
Right. So hey, we got some nice emails I wanted to share with our folks. And
did we?
We did. We got a nice little email sent into our website here. I have a question for Mike. Writes Annie Bell.
Oh, Annie Bell.
Why do you get so bent out of shape when people refer to the year 2012, 2012? You always correct them and say 2012. We don't refer to the year 1999 as 1999, mm-hmm. but as 1999. Mm-hmm. You are a strange little man, Mike Quackenbush.
First of all, I'm not that little Annie Bell. All right? I'm 6 foot tall, 191 pounds. I think it has to sound a certain way, and it's too clunky. These other ones, they're just not right. What do you, for example, the double O's, the decade of the double O's, I've heard them called the aughts.
Right. I never got into that.
Right. What do you call this decade, Clayton?
Boy, I don't call it anything. because I feel like until it hits the 20s, mm-hmm. it feels awkward.
Yes, I agree. And I think 2012 sounds really awkward. And I think 2012 with the conjunction and in there is also really clunky. 2012.
I end up saying 2012 most of the time.
Yes.
I think I've got it hardwired now. But I never did say, according to Annie, I never said, 1,999. That would have never made sense. But
no, I've never said that either.
But given your, given the clunkiness in your argument, then you would have called it 1,900. You would have called it 1,999.
No, what I'm saying is times change, right? In 1999, we were in a decade called the 90s. It was cool. What decade are we in now? I don't know. Who's to say what we're supposed to say? The answer is me. 2012, Annie Bell.
Are we in the teens?
Right. I don't know. All the old rules are gone, Clayton.
I mean, it's like time has shifted.
Mm-hmm. Into the future. Time keeps on slipping.
It is weird.
Into the future.
But she did go on to say, Annie continues to write, she says, by the way, my husband and I absolutely love the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. We know nothing about comic books, wrestling, they might be giants, and are far from techno geeks, but somehow you oddballs have won our hearts. Thank you, Annie.
So now you've minimized me twice, Annie. You've called me a little man and an oddball. What gives?
No,
do I know you?
They cancel each other.
Have we ever met?
That's why she knows you very well. They cancel each other out. So thanks to Annie for that. Which brings me to a good point. Our iTunes reviews. Why don't you tell folks about these things? Because these are really important.
Yeah, and ours are rotten. I don't know if you've ever seen. We have like -7 giraffes. I don't know how you, that's not even on the scale. That's not even an option.
Possible. How do we get animals in there?
Who's been picking these things? Listen, we need you to go over to iTunes, and we need for you to write a no less than 5-star review. Okay, Clayton every once and again is like, we'd appreciate a 5-star review. That's bunk. No, we need 5-star reviews. And you know what? We deliver this thing to you free every week, give or take. And there's all, I realize not everyone can go out there and support our sponsors. Of course, we implore you to go and visit their site, explore with their services and everything else. So that's really important to the survival of Grizzly Productions. But some people, it's just not for them. Well, this is a simple, free way that you can show your gratitude to those of us here at Grizzly Productions. Go over to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe feed and leave us a 5-star review with your glowing praise, because it helps us bubble up to the top of search results and things like the What's Hot column.
Exactly.
And we're hot. We're neither little nor odd. We are hot.
So we got some great reviews recently. I'll just read a few over the past few weeks here. This comes to us from the Because Show podcast. They might have their own podcast, but
it sounds like it.
So they write, I'm an ultra super picky podcast listener and am so happy that I found this show. Love the topics, love their voices, and love that they both dig Sting. Thumbs up, my new favorite podcast. Thank you so much for your nice review and a 5-star review over there. Caleb Wiles writes, I look forward to the show every week. The amount of overlap between my varied interests and the topics talked about in this program is staggering. The show flies by every time I listen to it. Keep up the great work, guys. And Jay Sweat One writes us, I love the chemistry between Quack and Clayton. I can't wait for a new episode each week. Even if their comic book or musical tastes are not in line with my own, I can never miss a conversation. I think we might have won some folks over on Twitter, actually. We're Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. And, some people writing, because we talk about Mike Nesmith here on the show quite a bit.
Yes.
Chris Lariato writes us on Twitter, and he says, was looking on iTunes for some Michael Nesmith songs. Any suggestions where to start? Mm-hmm. Does it get any better than buying the album and the hits just keep on coming?
I think that's a perfect starting point. And I had tweeted Chris back when I saw that flow through our stream a day or so ago. And my very first recommendation is a song from that album, actually, Two Different Roads. Because the tendency would be, if you were to look online, through the common avenues, right? Maybe you went into iTunes and tried to look at the popularity of certain downloads, or you, Googled something about him, very basic. Chances are what it's going to return to you are the songs of his that did the best on the Billboard charts, which are not necessarily his best stuff. His biggest chart hits were Joanne, Silver Moon, maybe Rio. That was definitely like latter period for him, and I really do like Rio. But those are the ones I think that are going to trickle up the most, especially because both Joanne and Silver Moon were on the Billboard charts. But neither of them are necessarily top shelf, I think. Now, that initial trilogy of stuff he did with the First National Band as a single piece, and you can get it that way in a collection of his called Complete, is a really fascinating trilogy of albums. And they're meant to be a trilogy, and it was really like a trailblazing thing into country rock. But as Clayton points out, it's one of his middle period albums, and the hits just keep on coming, which I think is really like his masterwork. And he's also got some that are kind of like frustrating albums. I think like pretty much your standard Ranch Stash, which contains a real gem of his called Some of Shelley's Blues. It's kind of like mired in like these weird experimental songs of his. The same is true of Tantamount to Treason, which is one of his albums that comes up a lot, it seems like, when we talk about him, in that a cover song of his, Wax Minute, which is one of my very, very favorites, is like buried inside all these bizarre experimental songs like Highway 99 with Melange and some of these other ones, where you clearly see like he's just, I don't know, like doing whatever wacky thing in the studio he wants to do at that moment. And if you've heard him talk in interviews, I think you get the vibe like he was kind of doing it to tick off the executives at RCA who wanted him to deliver a certain type of album. And as you've heard us talk about, especially in recent weeks with the passing of Davy Jones, like he was always the guy that was like, I will not bow down to the corporate desires or things like that. Like, I'll go off and make some weird experimental album that you'll hate.
Right. Yeah. I was listening to Tantamount to Treason a few weeks ago, actually. And it's funny. It's almost like he didn't try to put the album together well. Like, oh, I've got this good song here. I'll just shove it in the middle of some of these experimental songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess
it is a very odd piece. So, and then if you want to get into his later stuff, like, you know, the late 70s is when From a Radio Engine to the Photon Wing came out, which is the one that contains Rio. And as an album is one of his stronger efforts. And then I even like, you know, this is really one of the very last good albums that he put out was Tropical Campfires.
Right.
In the 90s, because then he really started to get off into doing ambient sort of new agey electronic stuff that is, to me, doesn't even sound like him.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, one of my my favorites, of course, is and his Just Keep On Coming. I think you can go wrong with just if you want like one off album like that,
right? And it goes down easy, right? It's only like a half hour long,
right? And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, can you buy just individual singles of Nesmith on iTunes? I think you can, right?
I'm sure
yeah.
You can.
I think they're all there.
Right. Now, that's interesting to me. Other than like a rare thing where like a song's not available by itself, like you have to buy it as an album. Are there a lot of artists that do that where it's album exclusive? You can't buy it on its own?
Yeah, sometimes they'll have, you know, you can buy like the single, but then there'll be like album only tracks mm-hmm. you have to buy as a complete album.
I see.
Most of the time they don't. But I think some of the, I don't know, maybe it's sort of, when I say unique, maybe I just mean unique circumstances, maybe like Nez, you know, on the surface, I wouldn't think that he's like a guy that would have all of his stuff on iTunes. Well, maybe mm-hmm. I would, because he's always out there in the forefront of technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he'd have all of his stuff up there, maybe. But I was just thinking, well, perhaps he would be sort of like Prince in that way, where he's got his own distribution way.
Mm-hmm.
But just glancing around here, and the hits just keep on coming, clicking on. The album is $9.90. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all the songs are available to buy. Individually, so you can buy them all individually. Tomorrow yeah. and Me, The Upside of Goodbye, 99 cents for these songs.
Right, and since there's only 10 of them, well, maybe that's why the price is $9.90, because it doesn't make sense. You'd pay more the other way. If you're going to go about it that way, then you could save yourself a buck. I think you could skip track 6, The Candidate. But I think otherwise it's an unassailable work from him, and a great place to start. It's a shame, though. What's frustrating about that is it is such a beautiful album, and there isn't another one just like it. You know, it's not like, oh, and here's the sequel. Whereas if you really, like, if you get into the First National Band stuff, there is, you know, there's other ones. Like, there's not just Magnetic South. There's Loose Salute and Nevada Fighter. And, you know, like his late 70s period where it was really heavily produced. And you could hear, like, the slight influence of what was going on in music creeping into his stuff. Like, if you really like Infinite Rider on the Big Dogma, well, just a year or two later then he put out From a Radio Engine to the Photon Wing, which is really, like, cut from the same cloth. Like, a lot of his stuff, they get paired together. He works in trilogies or a two-piece composition like that. I always refer to it as a diptych. Do you know a different word for that, by the way? Because diptych and triptych go together.
No, I've never heard that before. I mean, I know what a triptych is as it relates to art and painting.
Right, exactly. It's you know, a three-part composition
hmm.
that forms a bigger whole.
Oh.
You know, but generally speaking, in music, we don't use that, right? We'd say like a trilogy of albums. I wouldn't refer to the First National Band stuff as a triptych.
From the Radio Engine to the Photon Wing, one of his albums from 1977. It's only partially available on iTunes. They have track 5 through 8, and people writing, you know, in the reviews, not sure why this is a partial album. Sometimes, you know, rights for certain songs just not available. I don't know why this thing is only – that's weird.
He's a very quirky guy, but he also does own everything of his. So it was definitely a decision of his own. Like he went out there and bought up all of his stuff. So
if there's one album I would say buy above all else, it would be his 2005 album Rays. Pick that album up and do yourself.
I would love, what do people review that as? Do the reviews all start off like, what the heck is this?
Let me say this. I'm looking at the reviews for his album Rays, which is let me read the album review. I love this first sentence. Mike Nesmith is a puzzling character. Over the years, he's been a folk singer, a television star, and a teen idol with the Monkees, and an alt-country pioneer with his First National Band. Of course, most of that happened in the mid-60s and 70s. All these decades later, the erstwhile trailblazer seems as though he doesn't quite know where he's headed anymore. His 2005 solo effort, Rays, is a wild foray into spacey electronic music peppered with awkward guitars.
Mm-hmm.
Nesmith is a rebellious soul with more than a hint of an ornery streak. So whether he thinks this silliness is really good or is just the manifestation of his desire to be category-defying is anyone's guess. Regardless of his motivation, Rays lacks the straight-shooting charm and psychedelic whimsy that have made Nesmith's catalog so enjoyable. The ratings are actually mostly 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, well, writes this one guy, I didn't know what to expect with this album. Even the samples didn't tell me much, but I've been a fan of Nesmith for so long, so I had a lot of confidence it would at least be interesting. I downloaded the entire album and was pleasantly surprised by what I heard. It's not like any of his other albums. It's very atmospheric and orchestral.
Huh. Yeah, I think when it came out, as I'm on his mailing list, there was definitely a push from the people that run VideoRanch.com, which is his site, to give it positive reviews in iTunes in the hopes that would, you know, for the same reason that we ask, that it pushes to the top of search results and things like that. But I disagree with that, and I do agree with the review that you read at length there that, you know, I think part of it is what the reviewer said. He really does love being that category-defying guy. I've even read an interview of his where he said, this was back in the 80s when he was running Pacific Arts, he was saying that he thought that record stores should not divide music up by genre. He said he thinks that it's silly to try and categorize music like that. You know, that's definitely a quirk of his personality. But that review you read, I think, is pretty spot on.
Interesting. Well, hey, let's pause here and thank one of our show sponsors this week, shall we? Let's thank our friends over at Gazelle.com.
Mm-hmm.
These guys do a great job, and they've revised some things recently, but I'm telling you what, it's spring cleaning time, and you got to get rid of some of those gadgets laying around your house. So, Mike, why don't you tell us about them?
Well, maybe you're going to need some money, right? You want to help pay for that upgrade. You want the new iPad or the latest iPhone. You want some new thing, Android-y, blah, blah, blah. Well, now is a great time to sell your used whatever to Gazelle and get some cash so you can trade up. So go over to gazelle.com right now. You're going to get the best offer for your electronic devices, and do it today because all these gadgets lose value the longer that you hold on to them. Gazelle is simple and fast. You just go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com, like the animal. Find out what your gadget's worth. That offer they're going to give you stays valid for 30 days while you make up your mind, and then you ship it off. You mail it for free because Gazelle pays the shipping for you, and you're going to get paid fast. That check's going to come to you in the mail. They'll put money in your PayPal, or you get an extra 5% when you choose an Amazon.com gift card. Gazelle would love to buy your iPhone, your iPod, your MacBook, whatever that you're no longer using. So head over there today and find out what it's worth.
Thank you for that. Have you seen the new Avengers trailer?
No, I've seen the new Spider-Man trailer. There are a couple new Avengers trailers. There's one that's being called We Are at War that's going around, and I'm almost like I'm trying to avoid it because I'm to the point now where I don't want to know any more about the Avengers than I already know.
Now, I've seen one, and I think that might be the one that's called We Are at War. It was on during – I was watching Justified the other night, the season finale of Justified, which was awesome, by the way. season three just wrapped up, and we were fast-forwarding on demand through the commercials, you know. And suddenly we saw the Avengers, and my wife just stopped, rewound. She knew before that before I even had to ask, and it looked fantastic. Maybe you had mentioned this quote before, and I don't know. I don't know if I missed it in some other trailer or not, but Loki says to – I don't know if he says it to Iron Man, I think at one point. He says, we have an army. Mm-hmm. And he says, we have the Hulk, or we have a Hulk,
right.
Which was pretty, pretty, pretty badass. And then they proceed to have this drag down kick fight. And what I love about it is you get to see – you know, like we said before, broad daylight in the middle of the street, fight to the death, it looks like. Not in this dark. You can't see what's going on. Hulk smashing everything. You know, Cap kicking butt with his shield. Thor kicking butt with his hammer. Everything looks awesome. It just looks awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very, very excited for this. I was pleasantly surprised to see when I was recently down in Orlando that one of the monorails that circles through the Disney resorts had been done up with the Avengers all over it, you know, in the way that you normally see advertising around a bus or something like that, which is very cool. Even though they're, whatever they are, 30 years old now, those monorail trains still seem very sleek to me. And, you know, once we're clear of the Avengers, which comes out May 4th, but has already been screened a number of places due to, like, a Facebook promotion that they did, where, like, 10 cities got a screening of the Avengers early. All the reviews that are out there already, like, people who saw advanced screenings have been rave reviews.
Oh, good.
That this thing is just like, this is the superhero movie that you've been waiting for. And we really have been waiting for a while. I think that original X-Men movie directed by Bryan Singer either came out in 1999 or 2000. If you go back and watch that now and you see how far the genre's come in the last 13, 14 years, it's almost unwatchable. Like to see what was happening. And that was really what started this new era, in my opinion. The new era of superhero movies launched on the heels of that X-Men movie. It's difficult to go back and watch that when you know, like even the trailer, like the 3-minute trailer for the Avengers is more satisfying than that 2-hour X-Men movie in its own way.
The first one? The first X-Men
yes.
film?
Yeah. Right. You know, but up ahead, there's even more. You know, Marvel's I think all the Avengers family of things are they've partnered with Paramount for distribution of these. So next year, we've got Iron Man 3 and then Thor 2. Those are both coming next year. And then in 2014, there is the Captain America sequel. And then in the summer, there is another project that same year. So two summers from now, an unnamed sequel in the Avengers family. So what you could, whether implying it or not is one thing, but what you could infer from that is the fact that they're not naming what this other one is, to me, doesn't mean it's another Hulk movie. Like, there's no sense. If you're already announcing Iron Man, Thor, and Cap sequels that far ahead, right, the only other major player out there is the Hulk, because I doubt we're getting a Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. movie, right? I don't think we're getting a Hawkeye or Black Widow movie. It almost stands to reason that that sequel is going to be... Oh, please. Oh, my God. I would love that.
We got a Giant Man movie? I mean, why not, right?
Right. But that's the thing. I don't think we're going to see... They sort of implied that Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D., that his story is going to be folded into the Captain America movies. So I don't see him getting something standalone. And Samuel Jackson probably has the star power to do a standalone, whereas I don't know that Scarlett Johansson or Jeremy Renner, no offense to either of them, because they're clearly being cast as the B-list Avengers. You know, I have to believe this is the Avengers sequel, that this May 16th, 2014 date, that they're not revealing what movie it is, that must be the Avengers sequel.
Hmm. I would think so. And it's going to be huge. And I have to say, I just got some Hasbro figures from my son, and he loves them, but he's a little scared of the Hulk.
Right, sure, yeah. My son thinks the Hulk's a bad guy.
And you know, he's not that big. He does the Hulk smash. You flick his one arm and his other arm comes down. And they're small. You know, they're like, what, 5-6 inches tall, something like that? The small, you know, posable figures. Mm-hmm. But what drives me nuts, okay, so the Captain America one, you know, it comes with the shield in the box. But then it also, so then the Thor one is fine. That comes with a hammer. But they can never just leave well enough alone, right? For Iron Man, it should just come with Iron Man. No. It comes with some
skateboard,
right? It comes with some weird fusion shield, Right, and you attach it to his arm, and you spin it around, and it's come on, Iron Man doesn't do that. So when my wife was taken out of the box, she's like, "Well, what is this?" And I'm like, "Just throw that away. We don't need that.
Yeah,
it's not accurate to the character. You know, it's not something he carries. But why do they always have to do that? There's even like in the Thor box, there's a Thor hammer with whirlwind, or there's some weird, you know, it's like one's like frozen in ice or something like that, which is I guess okay, right? He doesn't have access to the hammer. Maybe he wants to try to get it back, and you're playing, and that might be fun. But then there's some other one where it's like hammer with this. No, just give him the hammer,
right?
Right?
No, I agree. Like one of the Captain America figures that I think actually maybe you'd given us for my son, like came with like a missile launcher.
Right.
When does Captain America ever have, and like the figure was made so it could go on his back, because you always see Cap running around with a huge missile launcher on his back, right?
Right. Like, of course you don't. But I just watched before the show, I just watched the new Spider-Man trailer. It's being called the International trailer.
Right, yes.
What'd you think of that? That looked pretty cool.
That was the first thing that really made me say, all right, I'll go see this.
Yeah. Wow, did that look good. And, you know, I think that they do such a great job in a way with him fighting and flipping through the air that you just never seen before. Mm-hmm. We just didn't have the capacity before to be able to do something like that.
Right. And it might seem very trivial, but I really do like that they brought the web shooters back into the mythos. Like, I really do like that.
Yeah. You know, I'm just curious how they'll be able to pull this off with the Lizard. You know, you get these little glimpses of him, and I just the quick glimpse that you get to see of the Lizard, I'm not sure that I'm in. I don't know. The one shot I saw before in that older trailer, he looked pretty cool. This one, I'm not sure, so sure. So I don't know. Maybe they're not done yet. When is that coming out?
That one's Midsummer. That one's very close to The Dark Knight Rises. I think they're only 2 weeks apart, those two. You know, there's a bit of a gap here after The Avengers, if I'm not mistaken. But, yeah, you never know. Like, I remember thinking that, too. Like, when they first revealed what Optimus Prime was going to look like in the first of the Michael Bay Transformers movies. And I thought to myself, well, that can't be what he ends up looking like at the end. You know, that bit where his mouth is exposed, you know. Why does a robot need lips? You know, Optimus Prime, if you think about him, he always has that, like, trapezoidy-looking shield thing that's his mouth. He doesn't have lips.
Right.
But then, you know, like, when he would fight, when Optimus Prime would fight, it would go over his face. And I thought, I can live with that. Now, if the rumors are true about Michael Bay making the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, now they're in the reboot for whatever that comes to theaters next year, where he's making them outer space aliens, like...
Right.
I don't know. But, yeah, you want to think, of course, like maybe it will evolve by the end. You know, the way Cap's costume did in the first Captain America movie, you know, you saw two or three different versions of it before you got the final one. And it clearly looks like his costume's evolved again for the Avengers movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you were down at Marvel Central, which has now moved to Orlando, Florida, which is now owned by...
Really? They're no longer based in New York?
Well, I mean, I'm being facetious a little bit. My joke was that it's now owned by Disney.
Right.
So, well, I guess that technically would be Burbank, right? I don't know. I don't know where the main nexus of Disney is anymore. World or Burbank, California? I'm not sure. I guess still Burbank.
I don't know the answer to that. But barring their appearance on one of, you know, the 20 monorails that run through the resort, you would never know it because there wasn't a whiff of Marvel anything anywhere.
Really? Not even any of the gift shops? Anything?
No, and I was in all the gift shops. No. Hmm. No. You know why? I'll tell you why I was in all the gift shops. Because everything at Disney is brilliantly organized, right?
Right.
Like, there's nothing left to chance there. At least, I've never been to the one in California. You know, that one was built first, Disneyland, and they had a very limited amount of real estate with which to work. And that frustrated Walt Disney. That was one of the leading factors in why they did the project in Orlando, or what now I discovered all the area that's owned by them is just referred to as Lake Buena Vista. It's not even thought of as being Orlando anymore, even though the Orlando airport is the closest to it. Because he could, by buying up all that swampland, there was all this space for him to do exactly what he wanted. And, you know, from the way the trees are designed and aligned so that you can only see exactly what they want you to see at the exact moment they want you to see it. You know, like,
right,
what is
the
visibility? Exactly, sight lines. That's what I'm getting at. Like, you can only see Cinderella's castle from this place and this place, and as soon as you move this way, it disappears from view. Like, you know, that was all very brilliantly orchestrated and engineered. Even the transitions,
even going from like Frontierland to what's next after Frontierland? Fantasyland?
Liberty Square is on one side, right? And you can get into Fantasyland that way.
But the transitions are meant not to be abrupt.
Right.
Which is interesting, you know.
They flow very naturally. And
remind me, continue with your story, but remind me to tell you what is a thorn in Disney's side as far as sight lines go. I think I may have mentioned this before, but when we come back to it, in a minute.
Right on. So all of their attractions empty you out into a related gift shop. You know, like you come out of Pirates of the Caribbean and you're dumped into a gift shop filled with merchandise for Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, like they're not taking any chances there. And while I was surprised to find that there was no Captain EO merchandise at the end of the Captain EO attraction, you know, for the most part, they do everything they can to maximize that, and it's very smartly done. You know, you have to go through that gift shop. You have to see all that stuff. And of course, if you're traveling with a child, you know, that grabs their eye, grabs their attention. They don't know that you have to walk through the gift shop as quickly as possible and not look at any of the merchandise. So, having seen all those, yeah, I was surprised. Like there wasn't a whiff of Marvel anything anywhere.
That's bizarre. I mean, but I guess maybe it's not entirely bizarre. I mean, if you think about it, they don't really know. I think that they're still trying to figure out the integration and if there needs to be any integration. I mean, I think with some of their properties, they're able to, you know, at least with like on the Disney Channel, maybe they're able to put in some Marvel cartoons. Maybe at on ABC, there might be a move to have some sort of superhero show because, you know, they own ABC television as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe show more Marvel-related movies on ABC Family, the channel. But maybe they don't want to muddy the waters by joining the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Although they did a good job. I think they really did a good job with Pixar, bringing Pixar characters into Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of it still seems a little disjointed. With some of the Pixar stuff, I still feel like it seems a little odd seeing Buzz Lightyear in the park.
Right. No, I agree. I think that is a little strange. And clearly Buzz and Woody are the two that they've tried to pull in the hardest.
Right. I mean, now, granted, they've done a good job of doing that
because
it's, you know, they sell like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. But I guess just from an aesthetic standpoint, I just don't know that it fits. You know that parade that goes through Main Square at Disney World?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Down the main section there. That, well, they, you know, they have like the, I think they have like the Toy Story characters come through, followed by like the princess, which is to me is, I don't know, just looks weird. Because yeah. Buzz looks like he belongs over in Tomorrowland.
Mm-hmm. And that's where he is stationed, by the way. If you're going there and you need to get photographed with him, he's stationed there pretty much all day out in the sun, which I can only imagine what that must be like for the Disney cast member inside that awkward, giant, hulking plastic outfit.
Oh, can you imagine?
They do relieve them quite often, though. There was several changes of the Buzz while we were there. Mm. But and he's very awkward, too. Like, you know, most of those characters are very huggable. You know, like imagine a child running up and hugging Mickey Mouse. Buzz, who's in this huge piece of armor, it's more like a knee strike to the face when the little one comes running in for the hug, like, Buzz, wham!
So. Oh, it's pretty remarkable. And they never have the same character pop up in the same park at the
same
time.
They're not in two places at the same time, right?
Right.
Although I will say this, we did catch almost a tiny bit of overlap. I don't know where it was, but we saw two different Plutos within a few minutes of each other, which is even that's quite rare.
That's bizarre. So this is the first time you've been there in a few years. What stood out to you? What was your most memorable experience? I mean, I'm such a fan of going there. I can't wait to. I think we're going to go there in the fall. I'm going to try to take the family down and go in October because at Epcot, which I love going to, they have the Food and Wine Festival,
right?
Which is fantastic. And so you walk around all the different countries, and in fact they add different countries in between the areas where there's space between the permanent countries, you know.
Yes.
So
they had one of the seasonal ones. You know, I don't know how long they stay in the rotation, but Haiti, which is not on the rotation, was there. And I'm sorry for how ignorant this will make me sound. I have so little interest in anything going on there.
In Haiti?
Right. Like, I just kind of looked around and I was like, not stopping here.
Now, are you sure that it was part of the Epcot theme, or do you think because of the recent earthquakes there that this is where they've given folks refuge?
No. These were Disney employees hawking merchandise, like, here's some drums from Haiti or whatever. And I just thought, nope.
Interesting.
Not stopping at your two little kiosks that you've set up here. If we had gone a little bit later, if we were there next month, you know, the United States is represented on that Showcase of Nations. And they have kind of like a little open-air amphitheater where they tend to get, I'm sorry to say, like washed-up rockers. You know, like the one time I walked by and there was Don McLean playing to like 100 people.
So
like
sad.
Singing American Pie, you know, since that's the only one of his any of us know. What is that secondary hit of his? Starry, Starry Night?
Yeah.
Isn't that the other one?
Yeah.
Yeah, in May, Mickey Dolenz will be performing at this amphitheater. Like, as I was reading, it was like, you know, this guy from Herman's Hermits and this guy from this band. And then it said Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. And I thought, oh, boy.
Mm. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. But so, yeah, actually, speaking of Epcot, those sight lines that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, if you're staying at, like, the Disney Boardwalk Resort, which is you can actually enter one of the side sort of hidden entrances near Paris at Epcot.
Yes.
And that takes you to the Disney Boardwalk, which I love, by the way. Mm. It's that sort of throwback. Have you walked along that resort at all?
No. I know where it's positioned, though.
And it's very much like the 1920s, 30s Atlantic City style, old school boardwalk theme. In fact, if you watch Boardwalk Empire on HBO, it's very much like that. Mm-hmm. It's got sort of the old parlors, you know, the ice cream parlors right there. It's got some of those old popcorn trucks, you know, that that are positioned outside. So it has that that old family vacation feeling from turn of the century America, and I just love that. So just the ambiance, walking around, seeing it. Obviously, it's all new and modern, but the resort itself is just gorgeous. One of those beach-style resorts from the Northeast in America. So if you get a chance, it's very, very nice. And you can just walk around the boardwalk, which circles the lake.
Mm-hmm.
You can take boat rides and such that go through Epcot out into that main waterway in the middle of Epcot. But it you exit right by Paris as you come through. And as you're over at the boardwalk, I mean, you really can't see the Boardwalk Resort from Epcot.
Mm-hmm.
This is a massive resort.
Right.
Right? And I'm not sure at what point in the park, and it may be on the Boardwalk Resort and it may be in Epcot, when you can physically see, and I think it's at Epcot, you can physically see that the hotels, the Swan and the Dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know these hotels?
Yes, yes.
They're side by side and
right.
They...
They have those massive sculptures on top of them.
Right, pink and blue or whatever they are, yeah. The swan and the dolphin.
They've turned green over the years. I don't know if they were once blue, but yeah, they're Statue of Liberty green now.
Mm. But they are not attractive resorts. They are not Disney-owned. And I think Disney was in the process of building them or something. My friend knows the story, but they ended up being leased out, I think. But they are the only hotels that ruin the sight line because you can actually see them from Epcot. But none of the other resorts that you stay at, like if you're at Magic Kingdom, like you can't see the Contemporary Resort. You can't see the what's that that Hawaiian style resort,
right? Polynesian.
The Polynesian. You can't see that resort. You can't see you know the Animal Kingdom resort from Animal Kingdom, if I'm not mistaken. So all of these different Disney resorts are a few stories high. And you can't see them from anywhere. But the Swan and the Dolphin are just sticking out of the skyline, and they sort of ruin your sight line. And if you go to Universal Studios, they never gave two rats behinds about the way in which the park looked for sight lines. So you can see all sorts of hotels when you're at Universal Studios. You can look right over, remember the King Kong, and you could see like the hotel right there.
Right.
So it just ruined the mystique of the park, you know.
Right, and this is something, I don't know if this is real, I'm just going to put this out there and you can tell me what you think about this, but I've been to the Walt Disney World Resort in Orlando, Florida a number of times now, maybe five or six times in my life, and I find it very difficult to form really concrete spatial memories of the place.
Yeah.
Like, where things are. Like, I know this might be close to this, but I can't imagine. Like, is it a 2-minute walk or like a 10-minute walk? Or like, where exactly is this in the park? Like, I realize this might be in Tomorrowland, but where do I really go to get to that? And I think part of that is just the human brain and the way we work, because anywhere else you go in the world, you can see where things are in relation to each other, and that's a memory function, right? Like, I know how many steps it took when I left my front door as a kid to get to your house, give or take. But because they've so engineered where everything is to hide things from you, like, you can't get a sense of where this is in relation to that, you know, unless it's something that they're right next to each other. There's no interference there. You know, like, how long does it really take you to walk from maybe where the log flume is, which I would guess based on a map, you know, the map of the park, must be pretty far from Space Mountain. Like, is that like a 5-minute walk?
Right.
Or is that a 25-minute walk? Like,
I feel like that's got to be intentional, right?
Yeah, like, but that adds to the level of mystique. It's difficult to form the same kind of memories about that place that you might. If I visited Dorney Park 5 times, I'd have a really good sense of this is where the Hercules is, you know, and this is where the Tilt-A-Whirl is, and this is how far apart they are roughly. But it's very difficult for whatever reason. I mean, unless I guess you're like one of those Disney nuts that you know all those crazy trivia bits. Every time I'm there, it's like, oh my God, like, it's like your first time there to an extent. Like, you might have these vague sort of fond memories, but I don't have the same kind of concrete memories about that place. And I think it must have to do with that, the fact that they've so engineered, you know, the obstacles or the things that occlude your view of certain things that, you know, when you're walking down Main Street, USA, you can see the shops on either side of you and you can see Cinderella's castle ahead. And that's really all you can see. And so you can only form that, you know, your memory is very limited in what it's capturing. And I think that affects the way you see it. It gives the park a mystique.
Right. When you're in that main square and you just emerge from Main Street right near the place with the fantastic ice cream sandwiches with the fresh made cookies with the big ice cream in between it. Oh, my God. On the left-hand side there. And then you look straight ahead and you see Cinderella's castle with the waterfalls, the water fountains and everything else, and it's just gorgeous, manicured lawns, you know, everything just looks perfect, right? Then as you descend, or as you go to the left towards, is it Fantasyland to the left that goes into the jungle?
Adventureland.
So you go into Adventureland, and you can't see Cinderella's castle, right?
Right.
And once you get on the riverboat ride, or the jungle boat ride, you can't see any of the rest of Adventureland. Mm-hmm. And you're in that ride wholly. You know, you don't see anything else. When you come out, when you're in the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse, you can see other things, right? Mm-hmm. I would think. But maybe not. I don't know. It's been so many years since I decided to go up in that tree. Did you guys go up in that this time?
Mm-mm. No, that's one of those. I've never done that one.
I did it as a kid. I just haven't done it in years. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, let's pause here and thank our other show sponsor, and then I want to come back and I want to hear about what you liked about this trip, new things, because I'm always fascinated by it. So, our friends over at Cobra, the makers of Cobra iRadar, and the brand new hands-free driving. You know, some states, in fact, North Carolina, I don't know if you heard about this, you're on vacation, but North Carolina, the city of Chapel Hill, home to the university, is looking to ban all phone calls in the car.
Hmm.
Hands-free headsets, they say, are just not good. You know, anything, if they see you with a hands-free headset, you could be in trouble. And also putting the phone up to your head is a problem. Well, folks at Cobra have come up with a great new app that you download. You attach it to this device for your car. And you know all about this, right? Because you plug it in, you press a little button, and it basically turns your phone into its own car speaker system. So turn-by-turn directions, all of that, just can control with one little button. You hit the little Cobra icon on this thing, and your whole Android phone is taken over with their new interface. So it makes it like a very car-friendly because it's got big icons. You don't want to be digging for like tiny little icons while you're driving, getting in an accident. But of course, you take so many road trips, that would be beneficial. And also, of course, you know all about the iRadar device.
Of course I do, yes. It's going to make you a safer, more alert driver. It really is a remarkable thing that our friends and industry leaders, Cobra Electronics, have come up with. Find out why it has won so many awards. Go over. They've built a site just for it, CobraEyeRadar.com. There's a little four-minute demo video that will blow you away when you see what this thing is capable of doing. And I guarantee, even if it's something you're considering as a gift for someone else, if you have somebody in your life that could use being a safer, more alert driver, and who couldn't? The Cobra Eye Radar is the thing. You just got to check it out. You can't believe what this thing does.
Indeed. So we're thrilled about that. So tell me about your trip. I mean, where'd you go this time? What'd you see and what did you like?
I went to the airport first.
Did you like that?
No. No, I don't. As I've remarked before, but not recently enough, airports are crucibles of bad behavior. People discard all sense of manner. They'll do anything to do, you know, if they think that they're going to miss their flight, they'll shove ahead of you in line. They'll bump you out of the way. They'll inconvenience you in ways that outside of the airport is not acceptable. But let me also add this. Maybe I was more aware of it this time because on occasion I was pushing a stroller through the Walt Disney World Resort. I was never so aware of how many strollers or other like child moving devices there are in play there, to the point where that this too, again, maybe it's just because you can't form the right kind of memories about the place. There are huge parking lots for strollers all over Disney World.
Right. And like, and for rascals. And hover rounds. I mean, you want to, like, you don't know whether a stroller's coming at your knees or whether someone who's just either too obese to walk,
yes,
or you know, is legitimately elderly. Not that you would be illegitimately elderly, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, oh, here's another reason for me not to walk anywhere. Zip by one of these large food stands and grab like a turkey leg in my hover round or in my rascal. But there are – you are correct. There are like large parking lots for strollers.
Right. Like I don't know how I missed these on all my other visits. Parking lots for them.
Because now that you're a father, you're aware of these things.
Right. Like a long time ago I had remarked to you there are two kinds of people in the world. They're the ones who have children and they're the ones who do not have children. And now that I've changed categories since my last visit there, like I'm so aware of that. There are Disney cast members is what they call them, employees – who are assigned to maintain the parking lots for the strollers. Like you'll come out and they'll have you know, of course you know where you left your own stroller. You'll come out and they'll have reparked it for you and there are attendants to tell you, "Oh, you know, while you were inside eating lunch, we had to repark the lot. So if you were, you know, over here, yours is down there now." I can only imagine how frustrating a job that must be. And you know, they're real Nazis about that sort of thing there. I'm sure like me, you probably heard this years ago. A mutual friend of ours and fellow Wilson grad, Stacey Hager, worked at Disney for a while, whether it was for like a summer. She had an internship there. And I remember she had told us that if they caught you on camera three times not smiling, you were fired.
Right. Now, is that true? I mean, I guess that's
I can't imagine
true.
She would lie to us about that.
I mean, do you just smile for 8 hours straight?
I don't know, but nowhere, with the exception of one security guard who was leaving for the day, he was off duty, there isn't a cross word. You know how it is anywhere else. Like, people just hate their jobs, right? At least they do where I go, which is Starbucks and the post office. You know, people just hate their jobs, and they'll talk to anybody about it, right? Total strangers they'll complain to. The airport's another great example of this.
Yeah.
But never – at one of the Walt Disney resorts right now, whether that's because they're genuinely happy or they fear for their livelihood, I can't say. But I did observe this going on. And this was one of the more intriguing things that doesn't involve a stroller. We were getting lunch one day, and I observed three or four fairly young people, like early 20s, I would say, with clipboards watching very intently what was going on at this place where food was being served. And as you would walk up, there'd be a Disney employee who would hand you a menu, and then they'd funnel you into one of like six different lines where you would go to a register, order what you wanted and pay, and then proceed to the pickup window to get your food and then find a seating, you know, whatever, move on. So I observed these people. They were studiously jotting things on these clipboards and everything, and I was fascinated by, like, what – first of all, why do you need so many people to analyze what's going on here and what is it that they're doing? So – after we ate, as we were leaving, I saw one of them away from the group because I thought approaching the group is not the way to go.
Right.
And I said to him, I said, what are you doing? Which was my greeting, which admittedly was somewhat brusque.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what are you doing? And he was from a college, and he claimed to be an industrial engineer, or maybe majoring in that. How that relates to what he was doing, I have no idea, because I don't really know what industrial engineers do. But he said, I'm measuring the efficiency of the people at the registers here, that from the point in time that someone gets in their line to the point that they proceed to the pickup window should be less than 100 seconds. And so I'm here, you know, measuring the efficiency of them because perhaps these cast members, if they're unable to maintain the efficiency threshold, would need to be reassigned.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's fascinating to me. And of course, while he's talking, I'm just trying to look at his clipboard. You know, I'm like,
right.
What do you have there?
Like, who's being fired?
Right.
Is it Tom or Sheila?
But that type of, you know, the fact that they are so detail-oriented is very fascinating to me. And my favorite attraction there since my very first visit as a child has always been the Haunted Mansion. That to me seems like such a strange thing for Disney to have. You know, that's so outside of what I imagine that aesthetic, the Disney aesthetic, to be, and I'm fascinated by it. There was a book that I purchased as I was funneled out into an area where merchandise was on sale. There was a book celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Haunted Mansion, which I picked up. And this is an official Disney book. Some of you longtime Grizz listeners know that I had another Haunted Mansion book, but it was compiled by fans. It was not an official release. One of the things in this official release, it was penned by one of the Imagineers who helped with the 2007 update of the Haunted Mansion. One of the things he talks about endlessly is the capacity issue with the Haunted Mansion and Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, you think about all the stuff that has to go into making those attractions. Like, capacity is their top thing. Like, you've been on both these rides, right?
Which ones? Pirates and which was the other one?
And the Haunted Mansion.
Oh, of course. And yes. And I've heard recently, of course, they've really tried to – there's all sorts of new science, the way in which they study crowd behavior, mm-hmm. and the way in which they can make these rides more efficient by whether it's, you know, having individuals out in the park sort of staggered around, kind of keeping people from going into rides with distractions by having mm-hmm. more characters. I know that recently they've added
yes.
more characters so that, hey, you know, your son wants to run up and get his picture taken with Mickey. Well, that keeps him from having to – he's not standing in a line somewhere.
Right. Right. Yeah. One of the things I thought – it didn't really dawn on me until I saw, you know, this trip around that – the genius of the Fast Pass.
Right. Which you enlighten our viewers. And I've never – I think I got it one time on a media trip to Epcot, the mm-hmm. Fast Pass. But I think what you do them in the morning and they're free, right?
They are free. They're part of your park's admission. And you would go to an attraction. Probably you'd choose one that has a really long wait that you don't wish to be in line for, right? Like for whatever reason, it seemed like the Peter Pan ride, the wait was always over an hour. So you would go up to the Fast Pass machine and you'd swipe your ticket, which is also your hotel room key and a million other things. And it spits out this ticket and it tells you, come back in whatever, you know, I might say, come back in 2 hours and you can get on the ride with virtually no wait. So now I was aware of that. The Fast Pass was put in place a few visits for me ago. You know, it's not as if that's a new thing. But one thing I really came to understand about that and what you're talking about with crowd behavior and everything else is while people are standing in those lines, they aren't buying anything else. They're not eating food. They're not drinking beverages. They're not buying souvenirs or gifts or any of the other stuff. But when they have this Fast Pass, well, now I have, you know, whatever it says on here, I have 2 hours and you can't get another Fast Pass. While you're holding a valid one, you can't get a second one. So now I have these 2 hours where I don't have to stand in the line for the ride that I want, but what else am I going to do? Now, of course, you might go then and ride another ride that has a lesser wait. Certainly, I've done that. But it never quite – you know what I mean? Like the timing of it's never like, well, I can go ride 10 other rides in this gap of time, you know, because there's a wait at virtually everything. And without fail, you end up somewhere else where you're spending money that you wouldn't have spent if you were standing in that line because they don't have people that come around and work the lines, right? It's not like at a baseball game when you're in your seat and a guy comes around with cotton candy and Pepsi. Like, there's no one that works those lines. So while the Fast Pass on the surface, I think, might give the appearance that this is like a way to dodge the long lines. What I really came to understand about it this time is they just want you out there, as they the line of Disney rhetoric, which is beautifully worded, is enjoying other park amenities.
Mm-hmm.
What they really want is they want you out there spending money, because you'll get to that point where I still have time to wait before I go back for my fast pass, but 20 minutes isn't long enough to get in a line or go do another ride or walk to the other side of the park.
It's perfect amount of time to eat an ice cream.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And the brilliance of that really dawned on me this trip.
Yeah, it does. It sort of gives you spatial – it gives you some sort of time space where you're able to enjoy the park in those ways. I know we sat for a little while in different spots and just was – you know, we're killing time. Maybe we grabbed a thing of popcorn for a little bit and go into some gift shops to kill time. Yeah, because with 20 minutes, a gift shop's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because they've built that in where you can only carry the one valid fast pass at a time, like, then you're trapped. You know, like that block of time has kind of trapped you. And I'd be really interested to know, I don't know that they would ever release this information, but the statistics of people who miss the fast pass, like they get it, but then don't come back. Because that, to me, when you have that, it seems like your whole park schedule then revolves around when you must return to this attraction at a set time, because you don't want to blow it, right?
Right.
Like, you've only got that one. There's no way I'm going to stand in line. And now they have those clocks out in front of every attraction that tells you, you know, there's a 90-minute ride or 90-minute wait for Peter Pan. When we first got there into the Magic Kingdom, we passed by Space Mountain, and the wait was already 100 minutes for the day. Like, the park just opened, and there's a 100-minute wait to get on Space Mountain. You know, you're not going to screw that up. Of course you're going to come back at that appointed time. The ways in which Disney engineers their experience to be exactly what they want it to be for their customers and everything else is a fascinating thing. And, you know, because they do keep a lot of that internal, right? Like, there isn't a lot out there. It's always like those unofficial guides like we talked about, you know, like someone goes rogue and decides that they're going to, you know, reveal some of that type of stuff. They usually keep it pretty close to the vest. I don't know that there are, like, really comprehensive books about that type of philosophy from Disney out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that people study the way in which they do it, though. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen certain news reports on their changes at the parks. They may play it close to the vest, or they may bring the press in at some point to talk about how we're improving efficiency at the park. And they reveal some secrets then. But I'm curious. So you, I think, stayed at the Animal Kingdom this time. Had you been to Animal Kingdom before?
No. And, you know, I just always kind of imagined that it was like a far more expensive and pretentious version of the Trexlertown Game Preserve, located not far from our home, where you pet a billy goat. But it is actually more than that.
Right.
It is like its own park now, with different, you know, in the same way the Magic Kingdom is divided up into Fantasyland, Tomorrowland, etc. It's divided up into sections. Here's, you know, Dino Land, here's, you know, then they have some that are, you know, all the Asian animals are corralled here, all the African animals are corralled here. So there is a lot more to do than what I imagined.
One of my favorite rides is at the Animal Kingdom Park.
Mm-hmm.
I was with my family in, I think, 1995 or 6, right when they had just opened and China hadn't yet been completed in the Animal Kingdom. So the elephants, all that stuff, it was still being built. But mm-hmm. they opened it anyway, and you could see some of the construction of where this particular portion of it was, you know, going to be built. And, you know, we didn't stay at the park, but it is a beautiful resort, though,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken. The
yes.
Animal Kingdom Resort is gorgeous.
Yep.
That big hall, it's like a big African lodge, I guess you could describe it that way.
Yes, I think that's fair.
And the... But there's a ride. We were speeding through, you know, because we were kind of wrapping up, and it was so hot. My dad always wanted to go in August, you know, mm-hmm. so it was the worst possible time to go to Disney World. You were just sweating buckets. Oh, and right now is a beautiful time down there, you know. When May hits, that's when the humidity is in full effect.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we were speeding through, and we were coming out. We're like, oh, we got to hit one more ride here, and we went through, and they had this. They had this dinosaur ride at the end. Not at the end, I guess you could have done it first, right by the exit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a back-in-time dinosaur ride.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I saw that now because I had a little one who was under the height requirement. We didn't ride that. But it did look like it was fun. It looked like an extrapolated wild mouse type ride.
Yeah, but boy, If you're going to go to Animal Kingdom, that's the reason it goes, for that ride alone. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe one of Disney's best rides. And it is scary. My gosh, with a kid, no way. But it's scary for me. You know, I was 19 at the time, and I was terrified. You don't know what's coming at you. You're in a time capsule, basically, and you get hurtled back to prehistoric times when dinosaurs were around. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the point of the ride was at the time, was maybe to find something to gather evidence, and you got to hit the time warp to get back home to mm-hmm. present time, is the idea. And but boy, when you're in that back prehistoric time, you really feel like you're in the middle of like some jungle, all kinds of creatures like leaping at you, and they're all, you know, and it's all done animatronically, so it's not graphics, not computer graphics, but these things come out of nowhere. Kind of, it's almost like the Jungle Ride, mm-hmm. but about 100 times better.
Oh, okay. So what you're thinking of is that ride is actually called Dinosaur. The one I'm thinking of, there is one that's called like Back in Time or something like that, which is it's all outdoors. It's a roller coaster.
Oh, okay.
And then, it's like, you know what I mean by those wild mouse rides where they take the really sharp turns at unexpected times to kind of jar you around.
Yeah, no, this is indoors. It's all in the dark. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is just called Dinosaur. Did you guys do that one?
We were cautioned, I think, by some guide that it was far too frightening for little children.
Yes, especially the T-Rex. I mean, I don't know that your son would be sleeping right now if he saw that.
Yeah.
It was quite terrifying.
He does love his dinosaurs, and he did get to go on a flying Triceratops painted lime green, which I think is an accurate depiction. But one of the things I did see about we were on maybe a train or like a tram through a part of the Animal Kingdom where they showed you the areas where – I didn't know this, but like every night they call in the animals and cage them. Like they built this huge game preserve, right, which they call savanna. They have these huge savannas for the animals to roam around on, but they bring them in at night and lock them up. And like they're showing you like the size of the one that is required for to hold an elephant and the size of the ones for the giraffes, which is all very impressive, and like the system of fences and everything else. And it really looked almost as if it was the movie set of Jurassic Park. Like it so strongly evoked what you remember from the Jurassic Park movie. And I'm thinking, well, you know, this is just destined to go wrong, right?
Right.
Like, oh, this is the garage where you put 10 elephants and you think that, oh, that's going to work, right. You know, like. So yeah,
and oddly too, Jeff Goldblum was running the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, I was like, oh, that's a bad sign right there, very bad omen. To change gears here very quickly, I want to talk about this. Back in 2006, Johnny Lang, who is a blues guitarist, singer songwriter that Clayton and I both like quite a bit, released his last studio album. Hard to believe it was 6 years ago since this guy's put the studio album out.
But I interviewed him during that time. I played guitar with him, actually. I think I told you that. Did I or not?
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. He is touring like a fiend this summer. Like an enormous tour. And I thought the fact that they announced this huge tour of his must mean that there's a new album of his out. Well, apparently not. Apparently he's got to do something with his summer, you know? Even though he's a young guy, you know, he's got a lot of kids. So maybe he just needs to get out of the house. I don't know, but he's coming everywhere. He'll be in York, PA in the month of May, and then just a week or two later, he's in both Red Bank, New Jersey and Montclair, New Jersey, and all over the United States, and also doing some dates in Europe, which is kind of unusual for him. He's typically like an American act, but he is doing some dates in Denmark and Norway, and he's playing like every blues festival you can think of. He's in the Santa Cruz Blues Festival. He's at the Chesapeake Bay Blues Festival, the Thunder Bay Blues Fest. Like, you name it, he's at it. And he tours around with Buddy Guy. So if you're going to see another blues act, like, right, what a great doubleheader that is, Johnny Lang with Buddy Guy. And, you know, he's guested on some of Buddy's albums. So, you know, they've obviously become good buddies. That. Yep.
That's great. Yeah, I'm surprised he hasn't released a new album yet. I mean, I got to see him play that night. I stuck around after the interview. He showed me some blues licks on guitar. It was a lot of fun. And he was just a very gracious guy. Very down to earth. You know, he had some deals. He had some problems with his label.
Mm.
And so his label kind of vanished. Mm. And so he had new material. He couldn't quite release it on this old label. And it was – so he was – it was almost as if he was like that guy in that movie Airport or whatever it was called with Tom Hanks.
I know of it. I never saw it though.
Where he's like – he has no country. Like, while he was in the air, his country dissolved. So when he landed, he was permanently stuck at the airport because he couldn't leave and all that. It's kind of like that. Like, he had this material. His label dissolved. And he told me, he's like, I couldn't. So the new album was called Long Time Coming because he said this was a long time coming. Like, he couldn't get it released because there was no real label legally. He couldn't.
Right.
Which is bizarre. So, and
very,
John,
very talented guy, though.
Yeah. John Mayer has a new album coming out. Just saw that. It's like a bit of a country turn for him.
Yes.
And people, you know, who've heard the single said it's really good. And they like that he sort of, he genre bends quite a bit. You know, he jumps to the blues stuff, then he kind of pals around here. So proving once again that he has a, he doesn't really care and he just wants to do what he wants to do. But we'll see how much, I don't know. Do you own any country albums?
You know, it's interesting that that comes up because we sort of started the episode talking about exactly that. Because a lot of Michael Nesmith stuff clearly goes into a country bag. But other than that, not really.
Yeah, me either. I mean, I have some bluegrass stuff because a few years ago I did a bluegrass special when I lived in West Virginia. And I fell in love with the music as a result of it. I don't own any more now. Like, I haven't purchased any new albums except when we have some folks on the show and I, you know, get a CD or something from them. But other than that, I haven't picked up any new stuff. But that's about the only, you know, the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou time period, that film is about the only stuff I have in my catalog. Yeah.
Like, that's, I was remarking about this to somebody the other day, that if someone were to say to me, do you listen, are you a fan of country music? My knee-jerk reaction would be to say no. But Michael Nesmith stuff largely falls into that, and like, there's no one I'm a, like, a bigger proponent of. Like, I'm so out there championing the cause of his music to everybody, and like, that's what the vast majority of his stuff really is.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I mean, and so if you think about it, if you're such a fan of that, I mean, it's probably not far afield from some other pretty popular stuff that's out there. So,
yeah, there's that. Well, I don't know. I guess that's about it. If there was anything else to talk about, we would have talked about it. And if we forgot anything, we'll talk about it next week. Because you know what? We make one of these pretty much every week.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it works. Oh, yeah. I did want to mention something to you. And I'm going to send you a photo of this. And I want to know from our listeners, and we can talk more about it next week. So what I'm going to do is take a photo of this, send it to you, throw this out there on the show, and then people weigh in on Twitter. We're Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter. If this has happened to you. Now, my mom recently arrived. Maybe a few months ago, they came to visit my house here in New Jersey, and my mom always brings a few boxes from the house, much to my dismay. This time, she brought a couple boxes of toys. I had some great fun going through it. I felt, you know, my old Michael Knight doll or figure with Kit, you know, that my son loves, so he's zipping around with the Trans Am on the floor, which I actually turned into the Ecto-1, by the way. I painted, I put some paper on it and drew, like, the Ghostbuster symbol to turn it into the Ecto-1. So there's some other fun toys in there. I found my Centurions, which I mentioned here on the show. Below, though, in this sort of red gym bag, were all my G.I. Joe toys. Now, I was excited the other day. I was in my closet here where I keep all my stuff in my office, and I was moving some stuff around, and I decided to go through some of these toys and kind of look at them, see if there's anything I could pull out and give my son or just play, you know, play with myself, basically. And I noticed that all the G.I. Joes were broken. Now, not broken like the leg, the knee was broken, or the elbow joint of the G.I. Joe was broken. No. I have a bag full of torsos, and I have a bag full of legs. They've all broken in half. Now, they haven't broken in the traditional sense where someone stepped on them, or we were playing out back and, you know, something happened with a transformer or something, you know. The rubber band that holds the torso and legs together on all of those Joes had just deteriorated and to the point of not holding them together anymore. And in this bag, they all broke. So I have a whole bag of legs and a whole bag of torsos and no complete G.I. Joes anymore. Has this happened to you?
You know, I don't know if I have any of my original G.I. Joes anymore. I went through a phase a couple years back where I eBayed a lot of them away. But
Man, you're lucky.
I'd be interested to see, like, is that going to be a new the new thing. Like, they've hit that certain age where they they do, they just disintegrate.
I mean, I'm gonna lay them all out, take a photo of them, send them to you so you can cringe. I mean, and some of them are the ones you had to mail away for, like Cobra Commander.
The hooded Cobra Commander.
Yeah. Mm. Zartan.
Mm.
I'm really upset about it. I opened them up. I'm like, well, oh, maybe this is just one. I pulled a set of legs out. I'm like, who's that? I'm like, oh, that's Snake Eyes.
Mm.
And then suddenly, all of them are like that.
I don't frequent any G.I. Joe forums, but I wonder if there's like that's the top thread right now on there. Like,
right.
The rubber band.
Like 2012 hit, and that's when they just gave out.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But I have to imagine it has something to do with them being stored in our 120-degree attic.
Yeah, that might be a factor.
For 20 years. That could have been the reason, right?
Maybe. That's plausible.
It's plausible. So anyway, I'd love to hear from our viewers if they've had that happen or if they have similar circumstances with old toys. Maybe there's some sort of rehab program I can figure out. I can ship them off somewhere someone can fix them.
Yeah.
Because you remember as a kid, we used to pull them apart, right? We used to hold the legs and kind of pull the top.
You would test them, yes.
Right. And so we always knew that they had a rubber band connecting to the bottom portion of that hook of the legs.
Mm-hmm.
So I always knew that was the case, but I didn't know that they would deteriorate like this. So I'll send you a picture. Everyone weigh in on Twitter, Grizzly Bear Cafe on Twitter or on Facebook, and we'll get to the bottom of this tragedy.
Fair enough. Well, until next week then, children.
Bye-bye.